You are on the next level. This is The Beautiful Truth, where the expression is still free.
20 seconds and counting. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour.
And you're very welcome. This is The Beautiful Truth on RakeForNews.com with Fintan Dunn reporting. Thanks for joining me, folks. Let me quote to you, if you will, something that was written by Matt Miller in the Washington Post back at the beginning of this year. He said, "What if we're entering an era of geometrically accelerating technological advance in which artificial intelligence, robotics, and nanotechnology will together pose much more profound threats to jobs, wages, and social stability than has commonly been imagined? And what if it's not just the unskilled who are at risk, but most of us?" Martin Ford's cautionary book, he wrote, The Lights in the Tunnel, is the most provocative 2009 book you'll read in 2013. That was a hat tip to you there, folks, that maybe if you didn't catch that in 2009, you should check it out. Because its author, a computer engineer and founder of a Silicon Valley-based software firm, has over 25 years of experience in technology development. He's written for The Atlantic, for Slate, and The Huffington Post. And he recently shared a platform with the Financial Times' Isabella Kaminska on the automation of the global economy. And he's joining us right now to ponder this question. Martin Ford, you're very welcome to The Beautiful Truth. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hey, Martin, at one stage you wrote about the wolf. You're the guy sounding the alarm. Well, with the Amazon drones, Martin, has the wolf finally shown up?
Well, I think it's indicative of Amazon's strategy. I mean, they're definitely extremely focused on continuing to disrupt retail, and they're going to have a big impact going forward. Whether the drone thing is going to work out or not, you know, I think that the technology is probably there, but there are obviously a lot of regulatory hurdles.
Yeah, quite a way to go. But it did, if you like, open up the space in which people can foresee an entirely new way of interacting. But even in something more mundane, earlier this year, Foxconn announced they would be taking on 1 million robots in addition to their 1.5 million employees. That was a pretty signal development which woke people up. Another sign that the wolf is at the door.
That's right, and it's not just about the United States. This is going to have, actually in manufacturing, I think robotics is going to have a much bigger impact in countries like China, because that's, of course, where all the jobs are in manufacturing. This is really a global disruptive force, and it's going to have an impact everywhere. And
well, China, an interesting case in point, because if you look at what's traded globally, stuff like automobiles is worth about $8,000 a ton. Stuff like sophisticated electronics, micro-precision and nanotechnology systems, about $72,000 a ton, and traded far more aggressively internationally than automobiles are. So this is a big business, and the Asians are leading in the hardware end of this, for sure.
That's right. We are seeing some reshoring of manufacturing now, obviously, but certainly in terms of the precision and electronics, they've got a big lead over there, and it's not just about cheap labor. It's about having essentially the whole supply chain over there, and all the vendors and so forth, the subcontractors that these companies depend on are all there. So it's very difficult for us to really bring all of that back, because tremendous traction over there.
Tremendous traction indeed. If you like, to an extent, we're doing okay, because in as much as China's really good at the hardware, stuff like Google Now and the development of intelligent agents on software systems in the West are more of a software and systemic advantage as opposed to a hardware. So we're hanging in there.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of software and so forth, we're still the leaders. But of course, those industries don't create many jobs for you know, average people. So that's part of the problem that we have.
Google Now, as a case in point, an intelligent agent that can understand you and answer you was another signal development. But you're saying that there's an even bigger game changer behind that, that we're entering an era where machines teach themselves or learn from us, and that the programming that we used to have to rely on to code all this stuff before won't be required to the same extent as these things program themselves.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the biggest myths out there that you still hear again and again, people mm-hmm. will say computers only do what they're programmed to do, and they say this sort of as a way to comfort themselves. But it simply isn't true anymore. There are lots and lots of technologies out there. Machine learning is certainly one where computers are in essence programming themselves, and in some sense they're also becoming even creative and penetrating into totally new areas and coming up with new ideas in a limited sense. So going forward, this idea that you've got to have a person tell a computer exactly what to do is mm-hmm. simply not true.
Yeah, yeah. You've divided it up in the book into software jobs, hardware jobs, interface jobs. Maybe you could just draw that out for us a little and the impact that these technologies would have on those different kinds of jobs.
Right. When I say hardware jobs, what I really mean are manipulative jobs, the kind of jobs where you've actually got to, you know, manipulate the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And those are primarily going to be blue-collar jobs. They're going to be, you know, manufacturing and some service jobs. They're the kind of jobs that would be replaced by robots. And we are seeing, you know, a real explosion in robotics right now. It's really coming on strong. Of course, robots have been around in manufacturing for a long time, but they've been these big, huge industrial strength robots that
mm-hmm.
are really heavy-duty, rapid things. But now we're seeing new lightweight robots that are able to really take on sort of the last frontier and are really starting to threaten the last remaining jobs that are done by people.
Yeah, the Amazon drones, the drones was an illustration of that. I was sort of ironically thinking as I was watching this thing doing the delivery aspect without humans being involved that, hey, those guys going up and down the aisles doing the picking in the Amazon warehouses, they're shortly for the bullet too. There's going to be a robot
right,
doing that.
Right. Yeah, so you're seeing machines that really have vision, that can see, that can begin to manipulate their environment, and they're pushing into those last remaining jobs. And a lot of those jobs for people are things like, you know, loading trucks,
mm-hmm.
you know, picking parts from bins and putting them in the next machine in the next station. But the robots are really getting better and better at doing that. And so that's the impact that we're going to see in manufacturing, but again, the biggest impact in manufacturing is going to be in countries other than the U.S. because we really don't have that many people working in manufacturing.
Mm.
Really disruptive thing in the United States in terms of robotics is probably going to be when robots really begin to move aggressively into the service sector. And I think one area that's probably very likely to be impacted is fast food, for example. If you can have Foxconn bringing in robots to do precision electronics manufacturing in China, then you can certainly also build robots that can build, you know, hamburgers and tacos and lattes and all that kind of thing. There's plenty of room for automation to move into those areas, and that would potentially impact millions and millions of lower-wage jobs that a lot of people depend on. In my book, I refer to those jobs, like fast food jobs and jobs at Walmart, kind of as the jobs of last resort. I mean, those are the jobs you take when of course, these better opportunities are all gone already.
Yeah, it's a squeeze from both sides because you point out that, let's say, somebody is working as a legal analyst in a large law firm. Even in that high-paying job, a computer has come in, a piece of software can now do the legal analysis they used
right,
to do.
Right, right, and that's the category that I call software jobs. In other words, mm-hmm. you've got the hardware jobs that are replaced by robots because people have to actually, you know, do physical things, and then you've got all these other, what we really call knowledge workers, people that sit in front of a computer and in one way or another they manipulate information. And, you know, software is getting a lot better at doing those jobs. There are a number of examples you mentioned. There's now software to do e-discovery, which means basically looking at court cases and figuring out mm-hmm. which documents are relevant. And that used to be done by people would have to go through cardboard boxes full of paper documents. Now it can be done almost entirely automated by machines. You know, machine learning in general is a technology where computers look at existing historical data. They may look at the way a particular job or a task has been done in the past, and based on that, they can essentially learn to program themselves to do much of that. So, you know, this is something that's really evolving rapidly, and I think that knowledge workers, white-collar people sitting in front of computers are eventually going to be impacted by this, and you're just going to need a lot fewer analysts and probably middle managers and those types of people working in large corporations because the software is just getting better and better.
But the industry in the United States isn't saying that this is going to cause problems for employment or whatever. In fact, it's saying it's going to, you know, save the U.S. economy, that by deploying robots in the United States, you know, that's the solution to getting back into the international market. I don't see how this works, Martin. Do you see how this works, saving the U.S. with robotic jobs?
Well, you know, in manufacturing, I think that they've got at least a partially true point. I mean, it definitely is resulting in some reshoring within manufacturing because you've got, you know, you used to have factories over in China, and in some cases they are coming back. I know of some examples where that has happened. The problem is, though, that when they build the factory here, there aren't many jobs because, of course, it's all machines in the factory.
Mm-hmm.
It still does create some peripheral jobs, though, and it still is good for the country to do the manufacturing here because, you know, there are advantages to actually being involved in manufacturing. But, again, the organization you're referring to is focused on manufacturing. And mm-hmm. as I said, in the United States, you know, really not many people, way less than 10% of our workforce works in manufacturing. So it's not that big a deal to some extent. So they will focus on that. But as I said, the real impact is going to be when the robots start to move into the service sector and they start impacting fast food and retail jobs and they start doing things like stocking shelves in grocery stores and things like that. And those are all, I believe, things that ultimately could happen.
Yeah, well, you know, Larry Summers has a diverging view from the vision that we're painting here. And he says, well, you know, the so-called computer revolution, technology revolution, output per person is not dramatically surging, which would be a sign of this huge productivity arriving into the economy. And therefore, there's really nothing to worry about. We can take this new technology on board, and it doesn't really seem to be making that much difference on the ground.
Well, I think that there's a definite lag between the time that these technologies come on board and really begin to have an impact and when they show up in the economic data.
Mm-hmm.
Productivity has definitely been increasing since the turn of the century.
Mm.
And I think that going forward, we're likely to see it take off even more. But it is true that it takes some time for all this to be assimilated and really show up in the economic numbers, which is part of the reason that, you know, I think it's a bit dangerous to just rely on what the economists say based on, you know, looking at numbers, because by the time they really see it and this becomes unambiguous and obvious, it's going to be pretty late in the game and it would be really hard to develop policies to deal with it.
Yeah.
What we've seen, you know, in the last 30 or 40 years, though, is that productivity has increased, but wages have not. Of course, wages for most average people have completely stagnated. I mean, someone who's relatively unskilled today, they quite likely in real dollars are making less than they did in the mid 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, productivity has gone up tremendously since then.
Yeah.
But all of that value has essentially been captured by business owners and investors and CEOs and people like that.
Yeah, and this people at the top thing, and the income inequity, which is the diverging gap. It's actually could be a symptom of what we're talking about, because if you get this where essentially those who own, control, program and operate the robots make all the money and everybody else is out of a job, that's a dynamic
I think that's definitely part of what's going on. There are obviously other issues. There's globalization and so forth as well, but certainly over the last few decades that has been part of the story of why we're moving toward increased inequality. But the really important thing is that in the future, I think it will become more and more important because technology continues to be subject to this acceleration, you know, Moore's law and exponential increase, whereas the other factors that are also playing a role are not increasing exponentially. So I think that going forward over the next 10, 20 years, technology is going to take on a bigger and bigger role and probably will become the primary driving force behind what our economy looks like.
To put some figures on it, a good estimate is that in Europe, say in the last decade, maybe 7 million jobs were lost due to technology. The figure can't have hardly been far off that in the United States. And curiously enough, the fall in the labor participation in the United States, it sort of matches that missing 7 million. I'm not saying that the technology displaced those jobs directly, but it certainly created a hole which our other problems were unable to fill.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. It's really hard to know exactly what's going on. I mean, it's hard to delve into the numbers and really figure it out, but I definitely think it's playing a role. I mean, I think that the decline in the labor force participation rate is in part because people look at the situation and they just don't have any marketable skills.
But even people like Paul Krugman, etc., they're not worried about this. The mainstream line is that economic law, which says that we'll always find new jobs. Look what happened with agriculture. 90% of people in agriculture 200 years ago, then only 40% of them in agriculture 100 years, now only 2% now. So we've been through all this stuff before and we came up with a whole load of new jobs. We'll do that again.
Yeah, I personally, I do believe this time is different, and the reason is the technology is now advancing with such speed, and also it's so broad-based. I mean, if you look at what happened in agriculture, that was a mechanical technology, you know, it's tractors and agricultural machinery and so forth, and it impacted that particular sector of the economy. And it's true that it wiped out millions of jobs, but those people then transitioned elsewhere. They transitioned into manufacturing and then later into services. But now we've got this really across-the-board acceleration where information technology is just impacting everywhere. It's going to hit every single industry. It's even continuing to transform agriculture. I mean, agriculture, almost all the jobs are gone, but there are a few left that are often held by migrant workers, for example, you know, picking high-value fruits and vegetables and so forth. But now we even have robots moving into those areas. So information technology is just everywhere. It's going to hit every single industry, manufacturing, agriculture, services. So there really isn't going to be anywhere to hide from it, and there isn't necessarily going to be a new sector to move to. So I'm personally very skeptical about millions of jobs being created in the future. You know, if you look at, for example, the companies that have been created recently, the really major companies like Google, Facebook, I mean, all of them are just extraordinarily capital-intensive. They use lots of technology, and they're just are like no jobs at all, just a tiny number of jobs, and those jobs are all going to very elite-type people, you know, that have very skilled backgrounds. There are very, very few jobs being created for what we would think of as ordinary average people.
Probably a good place to take a brief pause for reflection. You're on The Beautiful Truth with author Martin Ford, and we'll be right back. And so you're concerned that what's facing us, if we don't do something and begin to respond to this exponentially growing threat, is that we'll face the reverse Henry Ford conundrum. I mean, Henry Ford's idea that I'll pay my people well enough that they'll be able to afford to buy the cars we produce. Well, what happens if Henry Ford takes robots on and lays off all his employees? Where's the economy?
That's right. That's the issue that in my book, for example, in The Lights in the Tunnel, that's really the primary issue that I focus on. And the thing is that what people sometimes get confused about is that robots and machines, you know, they don't consume. I mean, they don't buy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way to put it.
Right.
You know, they do in a literal sense. People often will argue, well, that's not true. You know, robots do, of course, consume energy and they consume spare parts and all of that. But the reality is that those are part of the production process. I mean, if you've got a robot in an automobile factory and there's no one out there to buy cars, then that factory's going to get shut down and the robot's going to be unplugged, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, someone has got to buy the products being produced, and for the most part, that's individual people.
But how do we solve the conundrum then? You're raising a pretty valid point there.
What I've advocated and what I say in my book is that we're going to have to ultimately move to some form of a guaranteed income model where people are going to get an income whether they work or not. And that's the kind of thing that politically at the moment is untenable and people can't accept it psychologically. But I think it is probably a reality that we're going to have to deal with in the future. The idea that, we need everyone to be out there having the ability to purchase things so that we can continue to drive the economy. We're not necessarily going to have everyone be involved in production. So we're probably going to have to decouple the distribution of purchasing power from work, from traditional work.
Well, that's a political hot potato, isn't it? Because there's a lot of people using some old-style thinking in approaching these new generation problems. They're thinking in terms of, you know, I'm having to work, so why should I have to pay for somebody else who doesn't want to work? These are the talking points of the last 25 years, and likely that paralysis of vision will hamper the establishment's response to these challenges.
Yeah, I mean, it's politically, it's extraordinarily difficult to overcome it. You may have heard that in Switzerland they were actually looking at an idea for a guaranteed income. They actually I think they're going to have a vote on it. So it is not a new idea. And many people are also surprised to learn that a guaranteed income is not a liberal idea.
Mm-hmm.
It actually originated on the conservative side. For example, Friedrich Hayek. Conservatives usually propose it as a way to replace all the other mechanisms that are out there, for instance, welfare and unemployment payments and so forth. You know, it's a way to essentially give people an income so that they can go out and participate in the market, as opposed to having government take on a whole bunch of stuff. So it's actually more of a market-oriented idea.
The alternative solution would be for the government to come in and we're going to make jobs and then we're going to hire people.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, make jobs or build housing for people who, mm-hmm. who end up homeless because they don't have incomes. And pretty soon you get the government taking over whole sectors of the economy. You know, whereas if you just gave the people some money so that they could go out and be part of the market, then you wouldn't have to do that. But
yeah.
It's an enormous psychological hurdle to get over to start really discussing that seriously.
Well, it raises the issue of the economic system that we operate under and whether the current consumer capitalism system is fit for purpose and whether we need something like modern monetary theory, which is being talked about by Soros and others, including Adair Turner in the United Kingdom, a candidate for governor of the Bank of England. He didn't get the position, but he was outright saying that we have to consider unorthodox methods of injecting money into the economy in the absence of demand. Now, that's at the moment because of economic cycles, but the same argument applies if it's because of long-term technological displacement, doesn't it? So,
yeah, I think that modern monetary theory is interesting. It's most economists still consider it to be basically crazy. But I think there are important ideas there. I do believe that if we had a guaranteed income, it might be possible to at least partly fund that by having the central bank create the money, because the money supply needs to grow over time anyway. But of course, you have to be very careful there in terms of inflation and so forth. But there's going to be a big debate, you know, between economists over that issue, I think. But it is true that we need to I think, look at the economy in a new way.
You know, just punching through some of the bureaucratic and ideological resistance, when you phrase it as modern monetary theory, it sounds like a totally radical new way of doing things. But in fact, the Fed is already using GDP targeting as its monetary metric. So they're already using a performance or demand side equation. So it's not a far move from that to say maybe we institute Bush-era tax cuts, except they're big rebates. In fact, they're rebates right to the people, and they're in the form of something like a basic income.
I think that's the really radical move that may have to happen in the future is that, you know, the way it happens now, the Fed buys bonds, and that when it buys those bonds and settles the balance, the money is newly created. So it just comes out of nowhere, out of the computer, but then it gets deposited in banks. And the idea historically is that banks have then loaned out that money to businesses, and that sort of grows the economy because the businesses then hire people and so forth. But what we're seeing is that that's not happening so much now. The money tends to kind of get stuck there in the banks. And so the radical move in the future, I think, will be to, instead of doing it that way, to maybe distribute the money directly to people in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that you could do in order to get around the argument of paying people to do nothing is pay them for education. You show up, educate yourself, and pass tests, we'll give you money, because that's going to produce an educated population. And in a diversified system rather than a central command and control system, if you increase the number of intelligent, educated people out there, it works.
Yeah, and that's what I propose in my book. I think that we need a guaranteed income, but we should probably attach some incentives to it, and the most important of those would be in education, so that while everyone might be entitled to some minimal income so that they can survive, you know, if you go and get yourself educated, then you'll be entitled to a higher income. And that will create an incentive, as you say, to, you know, for people to educate themselves, because it's important to preserve that. If we really move into a future where even educated people have trouble finding jobs, then to to some extent that incentive to continue going to school and to work hard and to educate yourself may begin to dissolve, and that would be very bad for our society. So I think that it's important to preserve that incentive.
In that context of what we do with our time, etc., of course we have moved from working 6 or 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, no vacations, and no social security, to the 40-hour week and less. We're missing that this is the payoff that, remember, way back in the 70s, they used to say, we're heading towards an era of huge leisure time. We're heading towards an era of automation. This is that forecasted era arriving. This is the golden future. Why are we not embracing it?
Well, it seems that it didn't work out that way. I mean, there's all this emphasis on profitability, and, you know, now a lot of people do have part-time jobs, but those jobs don't provide a survivable income. And very often people go to work 2 or 3 part-time jobs just to get by. 70, 80 years ago, John Maynard Keynes wrote an essay about the future, and he envisioned a world where people might work only 15 hours or so. For whatever reason, that's not the path that we followed. And so, now it's very difficult to get back on that track, I think.
Yeah, to put it in macroeconomic terms, it's we've moved from an era of capital constraints to a certain extent, when we reinvented capitalism and we had a glut of capital, which we've used up, and now we're facing resource constraints. But we're also facing these structural constraints in the economy, which is the failure of the economy to come up with the new stuff. The failure of leadership, of thinking, to actually have a game plan for how we move forward. You know, we're just sort of walking blindly into this with no realization and no game plan for dealing with already now, over 90 million people in the United States who would do useful stuff if somebody would only organize things so that there was useful stuff to be done that you could get a few bucks for. And there's plenty of it. So this is a huge structural problem, an ideological, bureaucratic structural problem we seem to have.
Yeah, I mean, but that's what happens when you kind of unleash the market without, you know, any direction to it. So what I think going forward is that we need to, I still believe in capitalism, but I think we just need to sort of modify it for the future. We need to adapt it.
Mm-hmm. You have one section in your book, and I've been doing some thinking about this because it's an illuminating and inspiring book that makes you want to deal with these issues, because you can see from it how the challenges are huge. You talk about the China fallacy. Could you just elaborate on the China fallacy a little for us?
Well, I mean, the idea, there's this assumption that China is going to continue to get richer and richer and be able to employ all its people, and that's going to, you know, in large measure be where the future demand comes from. In other words, in the United States, maybe, you know, unemployment will rise and we'll have low growth and so forth, but China is going to just keep, you know, spectacular growth, and they're going to build this huge middle class, and that's going to be where global demand is going to come from. But the reality is that the Chinese economy ultimately is going to follow the same path as the U.S. economy. Their factories are going to automate. They're going to have to transition to a service economy, and they're going to have to do that in a time when technology is much more advanced than when the United States did it, for example. I mean, we created a very strong middle class because technology wasn't so advanced that it destroyed jobs. In fact, what it did is it made workers more valuable, and mm-hmm. That's how this country became wealthy. China is much later to the game, and so, you know, before the country even becomes wealthy and has a really strong, vibrant middle class, the robots are already coming in, and the software is going to come in and automate a lot of knowledge jobs. And so I think it will be quite a challenge for them to continue to employ all their people.
Yeah, one field that's certainly going to be impacted, perhaps more than any other, is the field of education. And you can see the early signs of that. We're moving from an education system centered on buildings and structures to one on just communicating the information as cheaply as possible. And the cost of delivering information, there's a website, alison.com, A-L-I-S-O-N, free learning site, there are many others. It's trending down towards zero or advertising on the page, and that's the cost of education.
Right, and that's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, of course, it's good that education becomes free and available to everyone. On the other hand, there are a whole bunch of jobs in education right now. I mean, you look in higher education, universities. I mean, you know, that's millions and millions of jobs, and a lot of those jobs are going to be threatened by this. You know, who's going to go to a second or third tier college and pay, you know, astronomical tuition to sit there in a class when you can get the same thing online for free? And when people begin to realize that and turn away from a lot of those schools, I mean, that's going to, you know, threaten a lot of those jobs.
Yeah. Who's going to operate without a Google Glass device on? For example, a surgeon who maybe isn't that experienced, but with a communications device which he's wearing as he's operating, he could be instantly in communication with another surgeon, a very experienced surgeon, who can watch exactly what he's doing and speak live to him as he's doing it. And that those kinds of technology and expertise assists will be going on throughout our industrial and our service sector.
That's very possible. And a lot of that may be offshoring too. Offshoring is going to continue, I think, to be a huge issue. You know, that these technologies are going to make it easier and easier to bring in a lower wage person who's abroad and perhaps do a job here in the United States. We see that happening a lot already, and I think that it's certainly poised to, you know, to happen even more. So that'll be another thing in addition to automation that's also going to have an impact.
There's also the impact of swarm type technologies, and that didn't come into the Amazon drones issue, but in fact, from a software perspective, this is really what we're talking about. We're talking about not just large drones that carry big packages, but tiny ones that carry tiny packages. We're talking about potentially automated swarm-based distribution systems for industry and service sector. Swarm distribution systems that are global. How much displacement is that going to produce?
Right. I mean, it's really hard to think of any industry that's not going to be subject to disruption. I mean, if you count the number of manufacturing jobs globally, you know, in all these third world countries, I mean, it's a staggering number. The advent of potentially automated vehicles, whether they're drones or ground vehicles and so forth, I mean, it really is staggering. And the thing is that it honestly is very difficult to think what new industry might possibly create jobs for all these people. I mean, it's easy to think of new industries that probably will appear, for example, nanotechnology and so forth. But you can tell instantly that these jobs are simply not going to have many jobs. I mean, the problem is that new industries of the future are going to be highly reliant on technology, and therefore they will, you know, be automated. They'll be doing things that will incorporate all this automation and information technology right from the beginning. So creative destruction is going to continue, and we will have new industries arise and new, you know, building new products and amazing new things, but it's very hard for me to see how any of those industries are going to employ the millions and millions and millions of people worldwide that are going to be displaced.
I'm with Martin Ford. You're on The Beautiful Truth, and we'll be right back. Looking further ahead, Martin, what's your attitude to what's portrayed as the singularity, a moment when all technologies reach peak and when there's some kind of symbiosis between humans and machines, etc., etc.?
I'm sort of ambivalent toward that. I'm skeptical to some degree. I have an open mind. I think that we could certainly enter a time of extraordinary progress. And ultimately, that's what the singularity is. That was the original meaning of it. A time when things begin to move so rapidly that people don't really understand what's happening. And usually that's associated with the advent of true artificial intelligence. In other words, someone will build a real thinking machine. Could that happen? Sure, it could. I don't know that it's necessarily a foregone conclusion that it will happen. the problem I have with the singularity and people like Ray Kurzweil and so forth is that they've added all this other stuff to it. There's all this talk of human immortality, for example. I mean, they're very focused on that. They think that once the singularity happens, we're all going to live forever. And I'm pretty skeptical of all that. I mean, the whole idea of the singularity really is that it's unpredictable. We don't know what will happen. Just that things will begin moving really quickly.
Yeah. And to a degree, if you understand the trends in software architecture, it's likely that, in fact, a central sentience, a central alert sentience like HAL, is really an illusion. And that what we're building is some very, very smart tools, except millions of different kinds of them, so that we're looking at an intelligent bot field which can supply information or whatever in response to you, but isn't actually a fully intelligent entity.
You know, artificial intelligence today is specialized, so it does specialized things, but that's part of the reason that I focus so much on this whole unemployment issue, because people do specialized things. I mean, that's the nature of our economy. I mean, that's what Adam Smith realized when he talked about the division of labor. As time progresses, you know, the things that we all do get more and more specialized, and the paradox is that is going to make them more susceptible to automation. All these specialized tools that are in no way intelligent, like a human being is intelligent, but they can do one, narrow range of things, extraordinarily, capable. And that's the problem. That's why machines are going to displace a whole lot of people from what they're actually paid to do in the economy. Whether machines will become generally intelligent in the future, it could happen. I don't know the answer to that. If it does happen, it will be even more disruptive.
Yeah. We've only sort of skimmed the surface, really, of what is a very comprehensive look at it that you have taken in The Lights in the Tunnel. Definitely the book to read in 2013 or over the Christmas period, perhaps. It's available on Amazon for under $10. It's available on Kindle for under $4. And it's available as a downloadable PDF at thelightsinthetunnel.com. And you can set your own price on that. But I'd advise you to pay the guy a few bucks. This is not and skim through the issues. This is very comprehensive and tackles about 60 major topic areas. So congratulations, Martin, on being so far ahead of the pack.
Well, thank you.
It's been very illuminating, and thanks for joining us on The Beautiful Truth.
Thank you for having me.
And if you'd like to boggle your mind a little bit with some of the technological advances that are taking place with the sheer scale of them, Martin is tracking those at his WordPress blog, which is also worth checking out at econfuture.wordpress.com and thelightsinthetunnel.com for that book. Okay. The externalized human collaborative mind is clearly emerging, and it seems that we are on the threshold of possibly the greatest change in human history. There's a new kid in town, and he's got a smartphone, not a gun. It's Homo Technos, the code warrior of the right brain revolution, electronic plasticity to replace and destroy the status quo rigidity. We're looking at the emergence of an internet-enabled, distributively managed socio-industrial system, a plastic and changeable one. All those changes lie ahead of us. And I've outlined some of that in part 4 of The Invisible Revolution, The Rise of Homo Technos, on breakfornews.com. Is the pen mightier than the sword? The smartphone is definitely mightier than the gun. The gun, a rather crude instrument by comparison. The smartphone, well, it's a product of the mind, isn't it? And this is the triumph of mind. Surely it is. The past, as I've outlined in audios on treeincarnation.com and regeneromics.com, the past is matter, and the future is mind, and the time is now. Future and past, both produced out of the now, the mirror plane that runs down through the center of your body. Your mind branches above that line, and matter roots below it. Creation itself started within this mirror plane and extended away on both sides. Increasing complexity developed on one side, abstraction on the other. These mirror pairings are simply pattern and pattern recognition. Can you recognize the pattern in current events? pattern recognition through layers of abstraction is mind. Matter and mind. Complexity and abstraction. Yesterday and tomorrow. Rest and movement. Slow time now. So tend the flowers. Unfolding petals in your mind. It's time to sow seeds among the hours. Eternal now for humankind. That's it. I'll be back with more. I hope you can join me for that. But in the meantime, for breakfornews.com, this has been Fintan Dunn reporting.
You always keep me warm. Hold me safe and away from harm. Keep day for night, and as the day fades, burn a candle bright for me. Will you always keep me warm? Hold me safe and away from harm. Keep day for night, and as the day fades, burn a candle bright for me. Walking into the sun. Walking into the sun.
Walking into the sun.